I'm Chad Reed.
I'm Hillary Langer.
I'm Gil Jenkins.
And this is Climate Positive.
The stories are always changing. What we think are permanent, borders or flags or currencies or corporations or religions, are under constant revision. You know, just in our lifetimes, think about how the major churches or political parties have shifted. And so if we tell a better story, that's how we get to a protopian space.
This week on Climate Positive, we're honored to host a special conversation with Bill Weir, CNN's chief climate correspondent and author of the inspiring new book, Life as We Know It Can Be, Stories of People, Climate, and Hope in a Changing World. Through a tapestry of stories, tales of resilience, community, and the indomitable human spirit, Life as We Know It Can Be celebrates our planet's marvels, contemplates our collective desires, and calls us all to unite with nature and each other. It's about preparing and planning for the future together. So as Earth Month draws to a close, I'm eager to share this rich, engaging, and particularly meaningful conversation with you all. As I record this introduction, I'm filled with anticipation for the arrival of my third child, reminded of the cycles of life and renewal we see in nature, cycles that echo through the hopeful narratives that we'll explore with Bill today.
Bill, welcome to Climate Positive.
Gil, thank you for having me, man. Thank you.
Oh, it's my pleasure. You wrote a series of letters in 2020 to your then newborn son, River, to read in 2050, which is really the inspiration for your great book, Life as We Know It Can Be, which I should say also includes letters to your daughter. As the father to a boy not much older than River, I have a toddler daughter as well and another son just a few months away. I was just really moved by the first words in your book and throughout, which I found to be frank, wise, humorous, and heartfelt. So I want to read a quick line from the prologue and then just ask you to expand a bit on the inspiration behind the book. So you wrote, River, you have a good shot at seeing the 22nd century. And when you get there, I want you to tell them how we came together, sorted out our shit, and wrote a better story. Please expand.
Well, as you know, probably, Gil, now you get this perspective as a dad. And with my daughter, who's now 20 years old, you know, she became sort of a living, breathing unit of measurement, time measurement for me, especially when I started doing international travel and really understanding when scientists pick out the year 2050. You know, I looked at her and realized she's going to be my age in the year 2050. So that inspired the idea to do a show called The Wonder List, where I went to the wonders of the world and wondered what would be left of them. And there were social, you know, change stories in those and over tourism stuff. But a lot of times it came back to just the physical changes of a warming planet, right? And then so when they created the climate desk, I'd been a generalist most of my career, but now suddenly I was just living, breathing, waiting in scientific warnings and peer-reviewed dread and, you know,
the apocalypse beat, right?
Exactly. Suddenly it was like things got a lot less, you know, I was a lot more fun covering sports early in my career, let me just say. I was a lot more fun at parties. But when my little boy was born, it felt even worse because on top of the climate that was unraveling that I could go and visit and actually see, we were in maximum lockdown, height of the pandemic. I would go on to cover the George Floyd protests that summer. And I started these letters really as sort of a cathartic record of this just insanely tumultuous seismic moment of history. And, you know, and using him as a, like the day you learned to open kitchen cabinets, your dad packed body armor and went to cover the inauguration in Madison, Wisconsin, because we had no idea what was going to happen after January 6th. And so the early drafts of this were super dark. And I was supposed to turn this thing in 2 years ago, and it got delayed for various reasons. And I'm glad it did, because as he grew up, as climate policies changed, you know, in the country, I was suddenly talking to all these enthused, you know, green tech investors and activists and land managers and regenerative agriculture, you know, and I could focus on it, the story just wasn't, this is a horrible thing and we're doing nothing about it. Back to you. You know, there was no arc to that story. Now there's an arc, an upward arc to the story. And so what started as sort of an impetus to be angry and take note of the destruction and gathered ideas for how my little boy should build a life on this new planet we made for him. Like, where should he live? What latitude? And what kind of house? You know, what about water? What about food? What about community? And how should he fill his pyramid of needs in ways that I never had to think about? And so the more I focused on the helpers and the doers and the dreamers, the more I came up with, wow, this is an exciting idea. This, you should live here like these folks, or we should steal this idea from this blue zone in Greece. Or the book ended up a lot more hopeful than it started. And I do think we're just not telling this story with enough of full color of human emotion. It's one note, you know, terrorizing or depressing starving polar bears, and none of the possibilities of a world transformed for the better and more equipped to handle whatever is coming. It's not, the bad stuff is going to come, and we have to be clear-eyed and honest with the kids about that. But Dr. Martin Luther King didn't say, I have a nightmare. He said, I have a dream. You know, that rallied people in a way that just anger and fear cannot. Those are still important emotions to have in the coloring box, but I just want to start a conversation, at least with my kid and to myself. A lot of this letter just to myself, like, look for the helpers. There's a way to improve everything in our lives, 5%, 10%, maybe more, you know, and you add those up over the course of a life, we can be net positives for good.
There's so much left to save, right? As you
said.
Yeah,
totally, totally. So much left
and
to
save. And let's get after it.
And save, yeah.
I love that, you know, and, you know, I just, which you mentioned King and these notes of optimism and outlook. Because the doom, you know, the doom breeds inaction. We need the soberness, but the spirit of opportunity. Again, you know, when I was reading it throughout, my favorite quote from JFK is from his American You peace speech. He was talking about nuclear annihilation, of course, but it's always resonated with me when I think about climate. You know, he said, for in the final analysis, our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this same planet. We all breathe the same air. And we all cherish our children's future, and we are all mortal. So I was thinking of that, like you hit on that. So I don't know if you're a JFK buff too, but
that's a great one. Yeah.
So thank you for this, what you've done here.
Thank you. And what's crazy to think about now, there's a very similar quote like that. I'd have to pull it up to get it exactly right, from Howard Baker, Republican senator. When Nixon was trying to veto the Clean Water Act, and the Senate shot it down unanimously, and he said, look, if we can't swim in our lakes and drink from our rivers and breathe our air, what good is any prosperity, you know? And it's been proven that we can tackle the ravages of this, of the byproducts of our development, without hurting economic development. And that seems quaint now to think that, imagine somebody like, you know, Mitch McConnell saying that today.
You alluded to another, you know, really powerful device, I think, throughout your book, where you unpacked Maslow's famous hierarchy of needs and posited, and of course, organized your book that, you know, those really need to change in the age of climate change and how it's shifted. Talk a little bit about that. I thought that was a very effective way to organize, and please expand there.
Thank you. Yeah. You know, I was kind of grasping for how to structure this book. I write for TV, which is, you know, for the eye or the ear, and writing, you know, when you say, okay, hey, I'll give you 100,000 words in a year. I was just lost, and I'm not an outliner. So I'm sort of like a man lost in the woods with a flashlight, you know, with no batteries. And I didn't know where to begin, but then I started asking myself, like, what made the problem? Like, most people are good. They want to do good, or they just want to take care of their families. How do we get to a point where we're like wiping out entire species? And it really boiled down to the idea of that we're made of stories, that we're the one species that has a capacity, thanks to fire we you know, found, and which helped us cook and unlock these big brains, and imagine alternate realities that, you know, and then rally millions of people around these notions of, yeah, we're going to land a remote control robot on Mars. We're going to do it. I'm like, okay, let's do it. You know, like our capacity for that. And, but the stories are always changing. What we think are permanent, borders or flags or currencies or corporations or religions, are under constant revision, you know, just in our lifetimes. Think about how, you know, the major churches or political parties have shifted, right? And it's, and so if we tell a better story, that's how we get to a protopian space. We'll never get to utopia, but it doesn't have to be all dystopia. And then, so when you're thinking about stories, and then it was like, well, why do we do what we do? If you start talking about human, if you just Google human motivation, you'll find the OG of this branch of psychology. Abraham Maslow was this sort of brilliant teacher from Brooklyn, where I'm sitting now. Miserable childhood. Mom was sort of just an evil villain in his stories. He found a couple stray kittens, brought them home. She smashed them against the wall until they were dead. And he would get beat up by anti-Semitic gangs and tried to join a Jewish gang to protect himself. And they wanted him to kill a cat as his initiation. So he was surrounded by this awful human behavior. And he hid out in the library and, you know, studied all kinds of psychology things. But in 1939, he wrote just one of his first papers, A Theory on Human Motivation, which didn't reference a pyramid shape, but that's the way pop culture took it. And if you imagine, for those who remember Psych 101 or haven't heard of this, it's imagine a five-layer pyramid with a first floor, the foundation, your physiological needs. It's stuff that keeps you alive. It's air and water and right temperature and rest, sleep, and, you know, homeostasis. Level two is, once you are able to stay alive, is safety needs, is shelter and rule of law and an economy. Information is a safety need. These are all the things that go away when I'm covering a hurricane, generally, for people, you know, the bottom two layers of that pyramid. And then once your belly is full and the door is barred, you feel safe, you want to belong. So level three is love needs, to a partner or a family or a tribe. Level four is esteem needs. You want to be respected within that group and to strangers. You know, that's why we practice Oscar speeches right into the mirror. Imagine, you know, being rock stars like I used to. And then the tip of the pyramid at that time, he called self-actualization, like whatever you're meant to be, you should have the freedom to be. And if you get the love you need, if you get the food and protection you need, you can be a force for good. And if we could just understand each other with these, on these basics, we could create a peace table and end wars. Instead, marketing madmen took his ideas and used them to sell us stuff. Now we're selling us cars, not just to meet our safety needs, but our love needs and our esteem needs. And so to me, it was like combining the idea that the story that I have been told on how to fill my pyramid, how to build my pyramid, was like an amusement park for one. It's all about whatever you want to be, you can be and go nuts. And you guys do you, but I'm going to be over here, you know, filling my love needs this way. And towards the end of his life, Maslow realized he'd made a huge mistake, because people were asking, wasn't Hitler self-actualized? He was the best murderer he could be. Yeah. And so what he realized at that point, what he mistook for self-actualization, the people he admired the most, the heroes in life, the surgeons and Nobel winners, for them, it wasn't about self at all. They carried one of 14 values, like truth, justice, beauty, you know, completeness, humor. And it was as much a part of them as an organ, you know, spleen or kidney. And so they pursued those with the best way they knew how, and success followed. And so anyway, it became a neat little way for me to suddenly, like, okay, we'll start with air. Like, what's in the air? You know, how do we understand it? What are the threats? What are the people? What are the solutions? What about water? And just sort of working my way up the pyramid. And then as I get into the love and esteem needs, I shift to my daughter, because she's at an age where that really matters now. In the age of social media, the love and esteem needs have been completely scrambled. And in the end, you know, I argue that if we rally around each other, around the bottom of the pyramids, the stuff I took for granted growing up, I'm from a like lower middle class house, but I never had to worry about my food supply or food was on the table. The air, I didn't see it. You know, the pollution had been cleaned up. And so, but now this generation, I'm afraid, doesn't have the luxury of that. And we have to help them fortify their pyramids and at the same time, make our lives healthier and happier. And if we do that, if we rally around our others around the bottom of their pyramids, we fill the tops of our own.
I loved your thematic pull through of the five stages of grief with respect to, you know, the lens of all these climate fueled natural disasters as we move through it. And you shared an anecdote of the book when you were hitting on the theme of the five stages of grief, where you challenged Mr. Al Gore, the Goracle, a little bit. And I really appreciate that, because, you know, maybe I'm mischaracterizing it, but his sort of in his normal frame, and we appreciate all that Al has done and is doing, but he sort of skims over the stages of grief in his regular talks, right? And goes right from doom to solution. So, and you know, that kind of threw Al Gore off a bit, but I think it was important that you did that. Maybe you could share a little bit about that story. And
sure. Yeah. This occurred to me when I was making a special a couple of years ago on CNN called The Road to Change. It was sort of a road trip across America to just see the effects, the attitudes about this big story. And David Wallace Wells's book had just come out, An Uninhabitable Earth. Very dark and really, you know, was just in, and he just basically in a clinical way laid out, here's what the current science says, here's where we're headed, you know, but that has changed. And it's not, and even he said now it's not as doomy as it was, because humanity is adjusting in real time. Right. But I interviewed him for that. And he was said, you know, if we do everything, if we do nothing that science recommends, coastal towns are going to be destroyed. You know, the entire states are going to burn in wildfires. All this is going to happen, and the world will have changed. If we do everything that the science recommends, that means a lot more visible wind turbines and solar farms. It means, you know, literally remaking everything in our lives in a more sustainable way, probably in ways you don't notice in a comfort level because technology has advanced so much, but it's going to change. And so it occurred to me that like the Goldilocks Earth that I grew up on is dead now, you know, or is on life support. And we have to grieve that. We have to wrestle with that. And so at the time I thought this is like a road trip through the five stages of grief, which are denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. And in the, you know, Petro states, a lot of denial. In places, you know, the activists are very angry. You can find those in both political parties. Bargaining happens in places like Miami or Charleston, where they're building seawalls or raising streets. Like, we're going to adapt our way around the problem. Still, please keep moving here. And depression hits everybody in this space, if you work in it at all. And then, but it's, acceptance is okay. This is what's baked in. I use it in the sense of, okay, this is a huge problem, but as my old man used to say, good thing you're tough. And so what's next? You know, like this sense of it. I was sitting down with Al Gore. He was having this Weather Underground conference on his farm in Tennessee, talking about regenerative agriculture, and very much, you know, as you say, the Goracle. Cool to talk to him and walk around his land, and I used a lot of that in this other specials I did on food. But I said at one point I had heard from other like climate psychologists who say this message where you skip right from the world is ending, But just don't forget to vote.
We
like,
got
you know,
it.
Like there's something you have to cycle through, the bargaining and the anger and the depression of all of that. And so I was just saying, if someone says wants to mock Al Gore as a messenger of this, maybe they just haven't processed through, you know, those stages yet, right? And he very much disagreed with that, because it made it seem like, well, we've accepted that Earth is dead, and now, you know, and I wasn't trying to make that case at all, but if you live in Lahaina, Hawaii, you have to mourn what is left of your, what happened to your town. And until you get to acceptance and get over the depression and get over the anger, that's when you go from survivor to rebuilder and thriver, you know? And so anyway, but I really dug into that premise more when I sat down to write the book and looked up, you know, the origins of this came from a woman named Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who's a Swiss. She started it. She wanted to be a medical doctor. Very stern father who just wanted her to be either a maid or a secretary. She defied him, went to med school. And when she started practicing in Chicago in like the late 60s, 95% of doctors wouldn't tell terminal patients they were dying. Like mortality was like a dirty word. And everybody knew, but as they did tell people, you know, when they were forced to tell people that you only have weeks to live, the clergy in her hospital said, you should interview these folks. We'd love to know what they're going through so we can ease their final weeks. And to her surprise and everybody's, everybody said yes, who like would sit down with her. And then that's how she realized that people were cycling through these five stages, not in a linear fashion, sometimes jump around, sometimes you go back from acceptance to anger and, you know, but by, she basically invented hospice care and was so good at this, at empathizing with folks, that now 95% of doctors take the family's advice for end of life care, you know? And so in not talking about the worst that could happen, I think, you know, I think Al Gore, you know, is now, his tone has changed. There's a lot of anger in his talk these days, especially towards oil companies in Abu Dhabi and the last COP. But, you know, again, there's no right way to move anybody. It's, it depends on the day, their mood, their, you know, what stage we're all in. And I just want us to remember that we're going through this together. And unless we do talk about it, you know, I think that's why there's so much anxiety among the youth, is the grownups aren't sitting around going, are you angry? I'm angry. Are you depressed? I'm depressed. What are we going to do about this? How can we rally?
Let's talk more about the incredible people you've met reporting and the great characters in your book by extension. And I imagine it was hard to decide who to include. Here's a few that jumped out to me I'd love you to talk about. And any others. The was it the fisherman in Maine who coined this great phrase, carbon Godzilla,
yes,
which I'm going to start using.
Do it. Spread it.
I'm with you because it reminded me, Harrison Ford, just randomly, I was at some climate conference in 18 and he, at the end of his speech, he said, everyone, you know, let's put down our phones and go kick this monster's ass. But, you know, you really expanded. Maybe it's just because there's a new Godzilla movie out, too, and my son wants to go see it. But, yeah, there's something like, yeah, we're going to beat this monster. There's going to be some ups and downs. But, yeah, so, but expand on this great fisherman in Maine, I think.
Who, you bet. So this guy's, his name is Marty Odlin. He's sort of a fisherman scientist. He's fourth generation Mainer right on the Gulf there in Portland, and always just dreamed of having a boat like his dad and his grandpa and chasing cod and halibut around the Gulf. And he went and studied robotics at Dartmouth, I believe, and earth systems at Columbia. When he came back to get a boat and get a fishing lease, he realized that the Gulf of Maine had warmed up four times faster than the rest of the planet, and all the fish stocks were diminishing. Lobsters were hitting it hard, but they were moving north too. And so he got mad. He said, well, if I can't have a boat named Running Tide, that's what he wanted to call it. He started an ocean repair company called Running Tide and called all these people he knew in the science world and said, what can we scale up? How can we help this problem and create nature-based solutions? And we were just talking about, I was bemoaning the fact that how we talk about the problem is a barrier to progress. Because first it was global warming, but warmth is nice. People like warmth. And then it was climate change. Well, the climate's always changing, you know? And then we say, well, we have to explain the greenhouse effect to people. Well, people's not afraid of a greenhouse. You know, that's where we get yummy tomatoes and flowers. And then you go, well, if we could just rally people like World War II and nationalize factories and recruit young folks to fight this. Well, that's easy when your enemy is wearing very conveniently scary uniforms, you know, and very easy to rally against a guy like Hitler and his minions. When in this particular challenge, it's everything around us. It's systems and things that are built in that you feel powerless to try to do anything. It's not like a moonshot because it's really almost 200 countries doing a moonshot at the same time. And so I'm going through this and Marty just blurts out, it's a Godzilla. It's a Godzilla. We have unlocked a Godzilla from underground, just like in the movies, by mistake. At first, he helped us do the heavy lifting. You know, he helped us build cities and expand lifestyles. But now he is so big and out of control. He's killing all the fish, melting all the ski resorts, ruining everything that's fun and free. And we should get mad and go kill that thing and chop it up, right? And that
get
to
the
me,
best scientists together, get all the
exactly
townsfolk
and what kind
together
of tools? What makes sense? What are you? Yeah. What's your Godzilla killing idea? Is it direct air capture or is it what, you know? Is it pumping biofuels back into old salt mines? And so I did. I met a bunch of these carbon removal startup guys, and Marty's went with he did the cost benefit on all kinds of technologies, and really settled on massive kelp farm, like floating rafts made of forest waste, seeded with limestone and kelp seeds, and they make these micro forests that gobble up carbon way faster than trees would. And the idea is then you've got technology that beams this data into the cloud for carbon markets to show how fast it's growing, when it's cut, it'll sink to the bottom and be sequestered there. And nobody knows if this will work at scale. We don't know how putting this kind of biomass at the bottom of the ocean. But for him, it was the most benign nature-based solution. The limestone in the raft helps, is like Tums for the ocean to help with the acidification that's happening. They're also working with oyster beds, for coastal communities. So you have that oysters really pull down carbon, they filter water, and you have a protein you can sell and eat. So he's tackling it from these ideas. And along the way, he invents a way to beam data from a floating raft in the North Atlantic into the cloud as a byproduct of his research, And so the more people start thinking like this, it just fills me with hope. And countries like Iceland are like, yeah, come here, try your rafts here. We want to get behind you on this. I love that. And again, I've stolen that metaphor, Carbon Godzilla.
I love it. On the other side, on the sort of climate resilience side, Archie from Maui, Kalepa, Archie from Maui. What an incredible human being there, who you encountered after the terrible wildfire, and as the community was picking up the pieces. And it's fair to say Archie gave you the title for the book too, right?
He
Directly or
did
indirectly?
indirectly. I mean, I was circling around it, at that time, and tried it out on him, and he helped me nail it. We went into the burn zone in Maui there just while it was still smoldering. And when you come ashore, I had been there in better days, and you see the contrast. It was like a World War II movie. And we spent a couple days sort of interviewing folks in the area, but couldn't get really into the town until we sort of embedded with some DIY relief workers who were taking a U-Haul full of relief supplies in and took us into this neighborhood in the center of the burn zone that they had held the line and it had survived. And right on that line is a guy named Archie Kalepa who lived there, who was a Hall of Fame waterman in Hawaii. He was a lifeguard who pioneered the use of jet skis to tow in to rescue people and then tow in surfing for big waves. And he teaches Navy SEALs how not to drown. He's like this otherworldly waterman and just so respected in the Native Hawaiian culture. His family goes back, 10 generations to when Lahaina was this watery paradise before colonialism, diverted it all, turned it into grassland. And in the middle of all this disaster, I pull in and he has this unbelievably well-oiled relief center with shelves of bottled water and food over here and medicine organized for, prescriptions over here. And he was bringing up musicians that night to lift spirits because they were going to have a cookout. And these are just shell-shocked folks who just watched their entire town burn down around them. Their jobs are gone. What I saw him do was fill all of every level of their pyramid of needs. Looking after their air and water. Wear a mask tonight. This ash is toxic, and we're trying to get a dusk, shield up here. Be sure to hydrate. When you see the Hawaiian Electric guys, make sure they're hydrating. Let's give a big hand to Auntie Sue who cooked this, unbelievable poi for us. And this is what we're going to do. Like very structured and almost a militaristic, I was blown away. And I've seen first responders around the world from Katrina to Fukushima to, Haiti. And this was a guy like, I want my boy to grow up to be like Archie Kalepa, and especially in an uncertain time, because in the best of times, that guy is saving lives. And in the worst of times, he's saving that many, many more lives. And going through so much of the politics and the anger at the officials, right? And the human temptation to divide each other. I've learned covering disasters that sometimes sudden earthquakes or hurricanes or even like a 9/11 draws people together immediately. You know, it's sort of because you're all going through the five stages sort of at the same rate. And then it's hashtag we will rebuild and all that. But the longer it drays out, longer it draws out, that's when you get your nerves get frayed. And the kids can't go back to school, and the FEMA check hasn't arrived. And you look at the neighbor and like, what? Wait, what has he got a trunk full of supplies? Where did I, you know? And so those moments is when guys like Archie are the difference between a community staying together or falling apart. And as I think about how my son has to build shelter differently than I had to think about, and has to think about food supplies and supply chains differently. That kind of fortitude, and I'm the kind of kid who made fun of the Boy Scouts, like a bunch of nerds. I mean, I love the woods. I love, backpacking with my dad was like, oh yeah, I don't need the merit badges. But now I'm the dad who becomes like, be prepared. Like, do you know how to read a paper map? Have you thought about an evacuation
And
route?
you got all the advantages, and I'm giving you those, but now you need to be strong for those who are less fortunate, right? I mean, that's
Totally.
it.
Climate Positive is produced by HASI, a leading climate investment firm that actively partners with clients to deploy real assets that facilitate the energy transition. To learn more, visit HASI.com.
Maybe still on the resilience theme, can you share some other surprising adaptations we're seeing from people and animals who are
Sure.
coping with rising temperatures? The penguins, I didn't know about these penguins.
Yeah.
Fascinating. And I guess the beaver dam analog was, I knew a little bit about that, but maybe start there or anything else that
Well,
comes to
so I
mind.
took inspiration actually from three animals for my little boy who's obsessed with all creatures.
Mine too.
It's so cool. And so the penguins are one of his favorite animals at the Central Park Zoo. We go to the penguin house. And I went down to Antarctica last year to do a story on whales, and it was the first time I'd been. It was my seventh continent. And I was greeted when we went ashore by just thousands of Gentoo penguins. And they were building nests. And then I realized that because of climate and because it had been a wet, late spring, penguins need dry rock to nest on. And they were making nests for penguins' babies that wouldn't have the time they need to fatten up and grow their feathers for the winter. So these chicks that were newborn that I was meeting and seeing these eggs as they were nesting, they weren't going to survive. There was no way. I got really depressed about that, but I called a penguin specialist when I got back, and she explained to me that that particular species is actually crushing the survival of the fittest test because they are moving, they're rolling with the changes. Others, like the Adelie penguins or chin strap penguins, which have a funny little insect, just like they sound, stripe under their chin, they're staying, like they're stuck in their ways. They're trying to nest eggs in standing water on ancient nesting grounds, and their numbers are crashing. The Gentoos are moving and thriving. Their like population is up thousands of percentage points. And the camel is another model I use because what we think of the camel as the eternal desert animal, it started in Canada. The camel's originally from Canada. And a couple of them wandered across the Bering Land Bridge into Asia and Africa. The ones in North America went extinct, but the ones that made it across to like the Sahara realized that the big hump of fat that they had for winters worked on deserts, and their feet for sand worked, for snow worked on sand. Their eyelids for blizzards worked in the sandstorms, and then they adjusted the behavior and their physiology. And so the lesson there is, as the planet heats up, we're going to be forced to either, move like the Gentoo penguin or adapt like the camel. And in places like if you live in Phoenix or Riyadh or someplace, where you're used to scorching temperatures that are going to get even more scorching. That means the cities will get lighter as more reflective paint is used. There's a, scientists at Purdue came up with a new kind of white paint that reflects 99% of sunlight and can cool an actual structure by 10 degrees. There's the policies of shade, chief heat officers now in LA and Phoenix and cities in Europe. Construction sites may move to the graveyard shift just because working in the middle of the day is just is not livable anymore in some of these places. But even places in the northern climates. You know, British Columbia, which saw hotter temperatures than Vegas a couple summers ago, or Yorkshire, England, you know, where they suddenly understand why folks in Arizona have oven mitts in the car to touch the steering wheel. The heat will kind of rearrange people, and I think, and have the biggest impact. But I met people like Annette Rubin, who was a NFL wife from the Pacific Northwest, married a Seattle Seahawk, had never lived in the Gulf Coast, moved down there, brand new mom, got hit by Hurricane Michael, and it shook her up so much. And the fact that her neighbors were like frogs in the boiling pot who accepted this, she's like, I'm not settling for this. I want to build a disaster-proof home. What would I use? And with no experience in construction, she's since imported a technology from Italy, invented by a guy who was building earthquake-proof homes using basically insulated styrofoam center with sprayed stone, shotcrete or gunite, what they use to make swimming pools, to build, you know, modular homes. You could shape them however you want and just turn them into these rock, you know, monoliths that'll stand for 200 years. And now she's trying to disrupt the Florida, you know, housing market, because after every hurricane, we go back in, build the same way, stick frame construction, you know, and she's like, we're smarter than that. And I'm just inspired by, you know, folks like that. And then there's so many ideas in clean energy spaces too and stuff. And so it's not just mitigating the problem, you know, trying to come up with a way to stop making carbon Godzilla bigger every day and in fact, chopping them up, building that industry in reverse, but looking for the smartest possible ways to fortify our lives, you know, while we do that stuff if storms are getting worse in the meantime, you know?
You're on Morning Joe recently, and you were asked, you know, what gives you hope in all this disaster? And your answer there, which you hit on in the book, was, you know, you reference Texas leading the nation in green energy. Number one in wind for a long time. Recently, number one in solar ahead of California.
Yeah, that was one that gave me a big boost, right? And when you think about the idea that for most of human history, we were just burning whatever was cheap and convenient, whether it was dung or whales or, you know, kerosene, and then something better comes along. And now, for the first time in human history, the levelized cost of energy of building a new power plant is solar plus storage or onshore wind. And it's, which is why not over 90% of power plants that are coming online now will be sustainable in the United States. It's same kind of numbers in India, amazingly enough. And when you realize that, like you say, places, and this is what's super interesting, and this happened with housing in Montana too, whereas states that had that hate red tape because they have libertarian Republican leadership, if they form a coalition with people who want to get stuff done, man, it gets done, right? And in Texas, they have their own grid. And so it couldn't be more just Texan, you know, you do you, rugged individualists down there. But that levelized cost of energy now, when you build that, the beauty of sun and wind is once you build the infrastructure, the energy delivers itself to you. Yeah. You don't have to go chasing it under mountains and oceans. But the byproduct is that is it's a lot less profitable, right? So the vested interests who don't want to give up their stake in the energy markets,
yep,
it's going to be a fight. But just the economics of this now is stronger than ideology. It's stronger than political identity in Texas. It's going to probably grow. Three of the five biggest green states are Republican-led, you know. When you look at the Dakotas with wind and Kansas and Iowa. And so I think that's going to – and then when you look at the boom in trying to capture that, a couple Sundays ago, electricity in Texas was free for 6 hours because there was so much sun and wind. And – If you get like a thermal battery that, you know, heats up like a big chunk of carbon till it glows like the sun and has enough heat to make steel, and you can use it to power a factory, or maybe you use pressure, underground pressure to store that energy. There's, you know, it doesn't have to be chemical lithium batteries the way we think about them. There's a million, not a million ways, but so many ways to store energy. That could create a whole new industrial belt in the wind and sun states, you know, the way that
We
created the Rust Belt up near the Great Lakes and shift industry around. Because now, hey, if I can run an aluminum smelting plant off of the sun, you know, it just makes that much more sense. So I think we're sort of headed that way, and we're not going, it's kind of the way at one point we weren't going back to horses. It just electrification makes the most sense for the future. The question is, Gil, that worries me, is whether it will replace the old legacy dirty energy, or we'll just figure out new ways to consume it, you know, between Bitcoin or cryptocurrency and AI data stuff. It feels like we invent energy consumption ideas just as fast as we invent new forms of clean energy. And it's obvious that the big, you know, petro, coal and oil giants are not going gently into a world where their business model has to change. And until we come up with a vaccine for greed or monomaniacal nationalism, like you see Vladimir Putin, where people are invading, there's always going to be, you know, this, but I don't know. I mean, we'll see what becomes of this revolution. It's a good fight to have.
I'm with you. Let's let's turn to your career as a journalist. And I've been a PR flack most of my life, so I couldn't do my job, I think, if I wasn't a great admirer of journalism and also a bit of a news junkie myself. My uncle was a former CNN correspondent too in the mid-80s through about 2000. So I've always been fascinated by the correspondent, especially the international one. And you've lived that life. But you became CNN's chief climate correspondent after the Wunderlist ended. Was that in 16 or 19? And I'm just
2016.
2016. Yeah. Okay. Talk about that. And I'm really interested in the power and the platform that the broadcast medium offers today for covering climate, right? The great issue of our time, but then also the limits, right? The limits of the soundbite, the unique visual, right? When it comes to reporting on this great issue. I mean, that is your daily, right? Balancing the needs of the medium and the challenges with the incredible platform that you have. But just share some thoughts on how you're thinking about that.
Sure. Yeah. No, for most of my life, I really resisted being pigeonholed into a beat. I was a generalist. I wanted to be an anchor, you know? And so early in my life, my heroes were David Letterman and Peter Jennings. And I either wanted to be a late night comedy host or a network news voice of God anchor, you know, which are very different paths. But I chose the more, you know, yuck it up path and started as a small market sportscaster because it was the most creatively liberating. And it was the days of snarky Sports Center and all of that. And I had an amazing run of luck where I got to cover, you know, ridiculous moments in sports history. My first year in a tiny little market in southern Minnesota, it's a little meatpacking town where they make Spam. But that year, the Twin Cities hosted the World Series, Super Bowl, Final Four, when Duke beat the Michigan Fab Five, Stanley Cup, and the U.S. Open. So I got to cover all of those as a wet behind the ears rookie. And then went to Green Bay for Brett Favre's first 3 years. I'm from Wisconsin, so as a Packer fan, that was thrilling. And then I went to Chicago, did a morning show there, and was the sideline reporter for WGN when the Bulls' last three championship runs. And then I had a really irreverent sort of special resume tape, given the, you know, creative latitude I'd been given, which got attention from the networks. At that point, I auditioned for The Daily Show when Craig Kilborn left and ended up having two offers to be the main sports guy at a station in LA and one in San Francisco. And I went to LA with the promise that they would help me develop some sort of late night show, but they didn't really have any interest. They just wanted me to do the highlights and shut up. You know, you get very little. And by this point, sort of the novelty had worn off, you know, I didn't realize how special, I had it. And when 9/11 happened, they sent me home for a couple of weeks. And then I was like, you know, I'd rather be like the Peter Jennings in me that I had been stuffing down was starting to emerge. And like, maybe I should do that. Or maybe I should just quit and go into doing the Hollywood. I quit the job as a sportscaster, spent a year writing screenplays and shooting pilots, you know, and trying to parlay my notoriety into like a scripted world, but nothing ever gets made there. And all my projects got killed. And then we had my then wife and I had our baby Olivia, and ABC News called and they had remembered me from the Chicago tape and they were starting Good Morning America weekend and brought me in. And I was shocked as anybody. And I came in thinking, wow, I made it to the big leagues. You know, I'm going to be hanging out with Barbara Walters and getting tips, you know, from Ted Koppel, not realizing I sort of entered into this just cutthroat, very competitive world, you know, of international journalism. It's sort of the last days of disco when the audiences were pretty big and the budgets were pretty big. And I spent a couple of years trying to be doing my Peter Jennings impression before I just sort of let go of that. And remember, they hired me because of the Chicago Goofy tape and started just being more of myself and got some big breaks. And Diane Sawyer at one point is like, go explain China to us. We hear some interesting things happening in China, you know, in 2004. And that just blew my mind, you know, now to go explore other cultures, to try to look for, you know, similarities and differences. And that was just became my favorite thing. And which led into when I left ABC, CNN, did that for the Wonder List. And then again, when the climate beat came up, at this point, I cared enough about the story and had seen enough of the world to feel like I could do it and jumped at it. And I'm proud to be at a place that really cares about the story. It was the first network to call it a climate crisis, to make it a full beat. We now have 14 people on the team all over the world. You know, some great writers and data visualization folks. And so I argue we're all going to be climate reporters sooner or later, the way everybody had to be a health reporter during COVID. The way it becomes more obvious, you will see that this is also a business story. Oh, and it is a health story, and it is a, you know, housing story, all that.
How about a sneak peek of any upcoming projects? Where are you going, or can you say?
Yeah, well, some days it's just sort of the news of the week. You know, we're heading into Earth Day and Earth Week, and we'll play it out to see, you know, what the shows are interested in. If I'm in New York, it's sort of a show's choice if they see something they want me to come and talk about, or if we have some original reporting we're offering. I go out into the world a couple times a month to shoot original pieces. You know, we're most recently doing the strange spinning fish in the Florida Keys. And I'm working on a special hour for Anderson Cooper's Sunday Night Show, the whole story, really around the themes of the book about adaptation and how climate is already changing construction and zoning and insurance. And I go to meet some of the characters in the book, the woman who invented the disaster-proof home, Annette Rubin, is in that special. Babcock Ranch, where they built the first solar village in America that survived Hurricane Ian, never lost power.
Amazing, you know, story.
And now is just people are lined up to move in there because they've seen what that looks like. And so, you know, just trying to assemble good ideas. And I think, you know, the folks who see this coming down the road, much like the Gentoo penguin or the camel, and adapt to this new reality, if you're a builder, and you start thinking more about, if you're in front of this passive demand for passive house construction, which are much better insulated. If you're in the solar, we've seen the solar, you know, employment, that sector, you know, grow in many ways. Growing pains, of course, come with all of these things. But again, for the, you know, graduates coming out of school right now, if people say, what can I do? Like, well, what are you good at and what do you love?
And then go do it for climate.
Exactly.
Right?
Go do that. Only do it in a way that leaves a net positive for people in life on Earth.
Let's wrap up, if you'll humor me, with our hot seat lightning round, if you're up for that.
Okay.
Sure. Okay. So, best piece of advice your dad gave you? Not in the book.
Not in the book.
Or it can't. He sounds like a character.
He is an amazing character. Smartest high school dropout I ever met. And really, really gave me my love of the outdoors and history and geology and all of those sorts of things. I mean, I'm tempted to go back what I've already quoted already and say, you know, it's the idea that when things get rough, good thing you're tough. And to try to pull on something, it's a pep talk in a way, you know, it's a declaration of faith and support, but also pulls you out of self-pity. And, you know, I do talk about in the book, the one time that it sears in my mind where he would talk about geology and he says, hold out your arm. And that is the length. That's how old the earth is, the length of your arm. Now take a nail file and just scrape the tip of your longest finger three times. You've just erased human history, you know? So we've only been here a blink, and to appreciate our capacity as world builders and world destroyers, and just how unbelievably lucky we are to happen to be breathing at this precise moment, at this spot in the Milky Way.
That's right.
I appreciated that.
How about your mom? Best piece of advice your mom was.
Yeah, she is a complicated character in the book, but she really taught me the idea that reinvention is possible. That if you don't like your general conditions wherever you are, a new future is like a U-Haul rental away, and instilled me with a real sense of courage and exploration.
All right. My son and I watched a few Wonderlust episodes. He was really into your Everglades episode with the python.
Yeah.
And we were talking earlier. He loves animals like river. He's into lizards, cats, and whatnot. And, you've seen some amazing creatures. We talked about a few. Give me your top five really quick. Most amazing creatures.
Interactions that I've had with? Yeah. Or just in, yeah.
Yeah. You have to photograph them or.
Sure. Yeah. So easy. Surrounded by grizzlies at Katmai National Park in Alaska. As the salmon were just starting to run, that was incredible. Lemurs in Madagascar, the injury lemur. We released a kiwi into the wild in New Zealand, a critically endangered national bird that they're trying to bring back. We were on a safari in Botswana where two lions were trying to take a big impala drumstick away from a leopard in a tree, trying to get it to drop this hunk of meat and watch this whole thing play out there. And then on that same shoot, we went to Namibia to look for one of the last black rhinos left in the world.
Wow. Oh, that's right. That was in the book. Incredible.
That. But then as a bonus, kind of just have to throw in the humpback whales we saw in Antarctica. Feeding with bubble nets where they blow bubbles in a tight circle to lasso the krill like tool use, you know? And so
I got to see that in this lifetime. That's a bucket list.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Nature.
And that's a wonderful comeback story. The humpback whale, we almost killed them all. But when people change the story and we were able to use the sounds of their songs and think about them in a new way, we brought them back from the brink. It's one of the great conservation success stories.
Speaking of changing the story, best way to deal with climate denying trolls on social media or in your inbox?
I there were days when I tried to engage them in, so let's talk, where are you from? There are days when I've tried to snark back at them. There are days I've tried to use them as, subtweet them as foils and fools. And I regret all of those, that unfortunately, I see social media and the way I was using it as a net negative for me. It made me anti-social. It didn't help the discourse. And I do realize the motivation behind that guy who's sitting behind a keyboard somewhere is angry at the system, is angry at a lot of things I'm probably angry at. And I guarantee if we sat down together and had a beer, we would find so much more in common. But the way we communicate is broken down. And I try to remind myself, this is what I come back to, is my daughter, Olivia, has this irrational fear of sharks, but I don't blame her. I blame Steven Spielberg, who made Jaws so convincing, with two notes on a cello that scared a whole generation of this creature. And I hope Olivia goes scuba diving with me, but I know that's not going to happen by me calling her an idiot. And so I try to hold grace for the story believers and really aim my ire at the storytellers who should know better, the ones with the biggest platforms who are obvious. But, there are lots of just now, and you don't know if it's weaponized trolling. You don't know if it's somebody in Russia or trying to push your buttons. But the more positivity we pump into the algorithm, I've found the more I celebrate just the solutions, folks, and don't engage with that stuff, my feed seems to be a lot more positive. And life's too short, to feed the trolls, I think.
Totally. Don't wade in the national marinade of misinformation, as you said beautifully.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, how many times have you jumped out of an airplane?
182, I think, is my last count. I was avid for a while. My dad was a skydiver when I was growing up, and he met my stepmom that way in Wisconsin. And so when I turned 18, it was like, I couldn't wait to do it. And I did it. I was living in L.A. I did it every weekend for a while. It was fun.
Okay. And did I, one of your stories, you, were you windsurfing back in the 80s? And maybe you still are, or you know, you're scuba diving, jumping out of airplanes. Have you tried this new thing called wing foiling? Have you
seen this thing? Yeah. It looks so cool. Yeah. I learned how to wind. My dad taught me to windsurf on a reservoir in Colorado, like freezing water, the big, like clunky Bic, you know, thing.
Yeah. I remember
that.
And
I've been like, for the last few years, I've been dying to learn how to kite surf. I actually took some lessons on the Outer Banks once, but then the weather changed and I wasn't able to actually get in the water. And I have seen those like inflatable foils, right? Where they're, you know, I love all that stuff. I might be too old to try it anymore.
Is it fair to say that once you've done the climate beat now, you can't really go back to doing anything else, right? Or maybe you don't want to, and to the point.
I really don't want to. You know, early in my career, it was just enough to be on TV, you know, and be in the action and be in a locker room, getting sprayed with champagne. That was fantastic. And that for in that moment, but I realized that I was still kind of the same miserable SOP who it wasn't enough to fill whatever, you know, keeps you on that treadmill. Like, oh, if I just get a job in this market, or if I just get that. And so having tasted, you know, this kind of storytelling we did a piece recently about a woman in Colombia who is reforesting. She was a landscape architect who was hired to build a zoo. I fell in love with this little cotton-topped tamarin, this cute little monkey that's critically endangered, lives only in this one part of Colombia. And she decided to get into saving this one species by regrowing forests. And it's such hard work. I visited her. You can't do this dropping seeds from drones. She's out there getting sweaty and understands the ecology. And she got hooked up with this wildlife conservation network, which was started by a bunch of Silicon Valley swells who were tired of sort of big nature NGOs and felt very non-transparent. And so they created venture capital for creatures and doers like boots on the ground conservationists to connect the money directly with these people. She needed to buy a neighboring cattle ranch, which would have added 1,000 acres to this vital cotton top tamarin corridor. And one of the guys she'd met on this at these expos said, what if we had a website where people can pick out a hectare from a satellite picture and for a one-time donation help you buy that ranch? We aired that story once. She got the money she needed to buy the ranch, you know? And awesome. So the power of like helpers connecting. This is one woman connecting with a bunch of strangers around the world who are looking down on these monkeys through a satellite from above, watching her bring the forest back. They can see in real time as the trees transform. And that's just, what else are we capable of? You know, imagine what we can do in terms of earth repair with stuff like that. So yeah, I like to focus on the helpers, as Mr. Rogers taught us.
Love it. Last one, our signature question we ask every guest to fill in the blank. To me, climate positive means?
Building, eating, living, doing, with our eyes wide open, understanding that every one of our choices adds up to big results for our planet, and we have the power to turn things around.
Well said, Bill. Thank you so much for this. This was really fun.
Gil, it's so easy to talk to you, brother. Thank you so much for your interest for having something called climate positive.
Well, we're in the spirit, man. We're in the one. There's so much to save. There's so much good. And it's not to be Pollyannish, but let's capture this opportunity and try to just do a little bit better.
Amen.
And a lot better.
Amen, brother.
Thank you, Bill. If you enjoyed this week's podcast, please leave us a rating and review on Apple and Spotify. It really helps us reach more listeners. You can also let us know what you thought via Twitter at @ClimatePosiPod or email us at climatepositive@hassy.com. I'm Gil Jenkins, and this is Climate Positive.